Chapter 50. Men paid their compliments. Sheridan was ill and could not come, but I'm to go with a general of his staff and see him before I go to Colonel Grant's. General Augur, well, I've talked with them all, received invitations from them all, from people living everywhere, and as I said before, it's a memorable night. I wouldn't have missed it for anything in the world. But my sakes, you should have heard Ingersoll's speech on that table. Half an hour ago he ran across me in the crowded halls and put his arms about me and said, "Ark, if I live 100 years, I'll always be grateful for your speech, Lord. What a supreme thing it was." But I told him it wasn't any use to talk. He had walked off with the honors of that occasion by something of a majority. Bully boy is Ingersoll traveled with him in the cars the other day, and you can make up your mind we had a good time. Of course I forgot to go and pay for my hotel car, and so secure it, but the army officers told me an hour ago to rest easy. They would go at once, at this unholy hour of the night, and compel the railways to do their duty by me, and said you don't need to request the Army of the Tennessee to do your desires, you can command its services. Well, I bummed around that banquet hall from 8 in the evening till 2 in the morning, talking with people and listening to speeches, and I never ate a single bite or took a sup of anything but ice water, so if I seem excited now, it is the intoxication of supreme enthusiasm. By George, it was a grand night, a historical night. And now it is 6:15. So goodbye and God bless you and the bays. Family word for babies, my darlings, SAML. Show it to Joe, if you want to. I saw some of his friends here. Mark Twain's admiration for Robert Ingersoll was very great, and we may believe that he was deeply impressed by the Chicago speech, when we find him, a few days later, writing to Ingersoll for a perfect copy to read to a young girls' club in Hartford. Ingersoll sent the speech, also some of his books, and the next letter is Mark Twain's acknowledgement. To Colonel Robert G. Ingersoll. Hartford, December 14. My dear Ingersoll, thank you most heartily for the books. I am devouring them. They have found a hungry place, and they content it, and satisfy it to a miracle. I wish I could hear you speak these splendid chapters before a great audience to read them by myself, and hear the boom of the applause only in the ear of my imagination, leaves a something wanting, and there is also a still greater lack, your manner, and voice, and presence. The Chicago speech arrived an hour too late, but I was all right anyway, for I found that my memory had been able to correct all the errors. I read it to the Saturday Club of Young Girls, and told them to remember that it was doubtful if its superior existed in our language. Truly yours, S50. Clemens. The reader may remember Mark Twain's Whittier dinner speech of 1877, and its disastrous effects. Now, in 1879, there was to be another Atlantic gathering. A breakfast to Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, to which Clemens was invited. He was not eager to accept. It would naturally recall memories of 2 years before, but being urged by both Howells and Warner, he agreed to attend, if they would permit him to speak. Mark Twain never lacked courage and he wanted to redeem himself. To Howells he wrote. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, November 28, 1879. My dear Howells, if anybody talks, there, I shall claim the right to say a word myself, and be heard among the very earliest, else it would be confoundedly awkward for me and for the rest too. But you may read what I say beforehand, and strike out whatever you choose. Of course I thought it wisest not to be there at all, but Warner took the opposite view, and most strenuously. Speaking of Johnny's conclusion to become an outlaw, reminds me of Susie's newest and very earnest longing to have crooked teeth and glasses. Ike Mama. I would like to look into a child's head once and see what its processes are. Ears ever, S50. Clemens. The matter turned out well. Clemens, once more introduced by Howells, this time conservatively, it may be said, delivered a delicate and fitting tribute to Dr. Holmes, full of graceful humor and grateful acknowledgement, the kind of speech he should have given at the Whittier dinner of 2 years before. No reference was made to his former disaster, and this time he came away covered with glory, and fully restored in his self-respect. XX. Letters of 1880, chiefly to Howells. He Prince and the Pauper. Mark Twain Mugwump Society, The Book of Travel, A Tramp Abroad. Which Mark Twain had hoped to finish in Paris, and later in Elmira, for some reason would not come to an end. In December, in Hartford, he was still working on it, and he would seem to have finished it, at last, rather by a decree than by any natural process of authorship. This was early in January, 1880. To Howells he reports his difficulties, and his drastic method of ending them. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, January 8, 80. My dear Howells, I'm waiting for Patrick to come with the carriage. Mrs. Clemens and I are starting without the children to stay indefinitely in Elmira. The wear and tear of settling the house broke her down, and as he has been growing weaker and weaker for a fortnight. All that time, in fact ever since I saw you, I have been fighting a life-and-death battle with this infernal book and hoping to get done someday. I required 300 pages of MS, and I have written near 600 since I saw you and tore it all up except 288. This I was about to tear up yesterday and begin again, when Mrs. Perkins came up to the billiard room and said, "You will never get any woman to do the thing necessary to save her life by mere persuasion. You see, you have wasted your words for 3 weeks. It is time to use force. She must have a change. Take her home and leave the children here." I said, "If there is one death that is painfuler than another, may I get it if I don't do that thing." So I took the 288 pages to Bliss and told him that was the very last line I should ever write on this book. A book which required 2,600 pages of MS, and I have written near 4,000, first and last. I am as sorry and flighty as a rocket today, with the unutterable joy of getting that old man of the sea off my back, where he has been roosting for more than a year and a half. Next time I make a contract, before writing the book, may I suffer the righteous penalty and be burnt, like the injudicious believer. I am mighty glad you are done your book. This is from a man who, above all others, feels how much that sentence means, and I'm also mighty glad you have begun the next. This is also from a man who knows the felicity of that, and means straightway to enjoy it. The Undiscovered starts off delightfully. I have read it aloud to Mrs. 100, and we vastly enjoyed it. Well, time's about up. Must drop a line to Aldrich. Ears ever, Mark. In a letter which Mark Twain wrote to his brother Orion at this period, we get the first hint of a venture which was to play an increasingly important part in the Hartford home and fortunes during the next 10 or 12 years. This was the type-setting machine investment, which, in the end, all but wrecked Mark Twain's finances. There is but a brief mention of it in the letter to Orion, and the letter itself is not worth preserving, but as references to the achine appear with increasing frequency, it seems proper to record here its first mention. In the same letter he suggests to his brother that he undertake an absolutely truthful autobiography, a confession in which nothing is to be withheld. He cites the value of Casanova's memories, and the confessions of Rousseau. Of course, any literary suggestion from Rother Sam was gospel to Orion, who began at once piling up manuscript at a great rate. Meantime, Mark Twain himself, having got A Tramp Abroad on the presses, was at work with enthusiasm on a story begun nearly 3 years before at Quarry Farm, a story for children its name, as he called it then, The Little Prince and the Little Pauper. He was presently writing to Howells his delight in the new work. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, MCH. 11, 80. My dear owls, I take so much pleasure in my story that I am loth to hurry, not wanting to get it done. Did I ever tell you the plot of it? It begins at 9 a.m., Jan. 27, 1547, 17 and a half hours before Henry V is death, by the swapping of clothes and place, between the Prince of Wales and a pauper boy of the same age and countenance and half as much learning, and still more genius and imagination, and after that, the rightful small king has a rough time among tramps and ruffians in the country parts of Kent, whilst the small bogus king has a gilded, unworshipped and dreary and restrained and cussed time of it on the throne, and this all goes on for 3 weeks till the midst of the coronation grandeurs in Westminster Abbey. February 20, when the ragged true king forces his way in, but cannot prove his genuineness until the bogus king, by a remembered incident of the first day, is able to prove it for him, whereupon clothes are changed, and the coronation proceeds under the new and rightful conditions. My idea is to afford a realizing sense of the exceeding severity of the laws of that day, by inflicting some of their penalties upon the king himself and allowing him a chance to see the rest of them applied to others, all of which is to account for certain mildnesses which distinguished Edward V's reign from those that preceded and followed it. Imagine this fact. I have even fascinated Mrs. Clemens with this yarn for youth. My stuff generally gets considerable damning with faint praise out of her, but this time it is all the other way. She is become the horse leech's daughter, and my mill doesn't grind fast enough to suit her. This is no mean triumph, my dear sir. Last night, for the first time in ages, we went to the theater to see Yorick's Love. The magnificence of it is beyond praise. The language is so beautiful, the passion so fine, the plot so ingenious, the whole thing so stirring, so charming, so pathetic. But I will clip from the current, it says it right. And what a good company it is, and how like live people they all acted. The he's and the who's had a pleasant sound, since it is the language of the prince and the pauper. You've done the country a service in that admirable work. Here's ever, Mark. The play, Yorick's Love, mentioned in this letter, was one which Howells had done for Lawrence Barrett. Onion Clemens, meantime, was forwarding his manuscript, and for once seems to have won his brother's approval, so much so that Mark Twain was willing, indeed anxious, that Howells should run the autobiography in the Atlantic. We may imagine how Onion prized the words of commendation which follow. To Orion Clemens. May 6, 80. My dear brother, it is a model autobiography. Continue to develop your character in the same gradual, inconspicuous and apparently unconscious way. The reader, up to this time, may have his doubts, perhaps, but he can't say decidedly, this writer is not such a simpleton as he has been letting on to be. Keep him in that state of mind. If, when you shall have finished, the reader shall say, the man is an ass, but I really don't know, whether he knows it or not, your work will be a triumph. Stop rewriting. I saw places in your last batch, where rewriting had done formidable injury. Do not try to find those places, else you will mar them further, by trying to better them. It is perilous to revise a book, while it is underway. All of us have injured our books in that foolish way. Keep in mind what I told you when you recollect something which belonged in an earlier chapter. Do not go back, but jam it in where you are. Discursiveness does not hurt an autobiography in the least. I have penciled the MS here and there, but have not needed to make any criticisms, or to knock out anything. The elder Bliss has heart disease badly, and thenceforth his life hangs upon a thread. Dear bro Sam. But Howells could not bring himself to print so frank a confession as Orion had been willing to make. Tear on my heart, he said, and I felt haggard after I had finished it. The writer's soul is laid bare. It is shocking. Howells added that the best touches in it were those which made one acquainted with the writer's brother, that is to say, Mark Twain, and that these would prove valuable material hereafter, a true prophecy, For Mark Twain's early biography would have lacked most of its vital incident, and at least half of its background, without those faithful chapters, fortunately preserved. Had Onion continued, as he began, the work might have proved an important contribution to literature, but he went trailing off into bypaths of theology and discussion, where the interest was lost. There were, perhaps, as many as 2,000 pages of it, which few could undertake to read. Mark Twain's mind was always busy with plans and inventions, many of them of serious intent, some semi-serious, others of a purely whimsical character. Once he proposed a Otis Club, of which the first and main qualification for membership was modesty. Tea present, he wrote, I am the only member, and as the modesty required must be of a quite aggravated type, the enterprise did seem for a time doomed to stop dead still with myself, for lack of further material. But upon reflection I have come to the conclusion that you are eligible. Therefore, I have held a meeting and voted to offer you the distinction of membership. I do not know that we can find any others, though I have had some thought of Hay, Warner, Twitchell, Aldrich, Osgood, Fields, Higginson, and a few more together with Mrs. Howells, Mrs. Clemens, and certain others of the sex. Howells replied that the only reason he had for not joining the modest club was that he was too modest to confess his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.